Hour number two, Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. This Friday morning, hope everybody's having a good day thus far. And actually, snowy Nashville. Hard to believe. 72 degrees on Monday. Flooding on Thursday. Snow on Friday. Gotta love it. Let's bring in Greg McElroy. Always enjoy our conversations with him. He's going to be busy this weekend. Of course, he is a part of a lot of football coverage on ESPN, college football, but also going to be moving into the booth for the XFL that we'll get into in just a bit that debuts this weekend. Greg, how you doing?
What's going on, fellas? How y'all doing?
Well, you just heard the weather forecast. You've been in Nashville. It's a little crazy around here right now.
Dude, I spent 6 hours in Atlanta Airport yesterday, so like no rain, sunny, perfect. I'm on board for just about anything, knowing the weather that rolled through the southeast over the last 2 days. So I'm pretty fired up about what you guys just gave me right there. I might have to head to Nashville Saturday night, maybe hit the strip, and maybe go down to Munbrian for a few. What do you think?
It may be 80 by then, Greg. Who knows?
I love it. Maybe to get a tea time over there at Bellmead or like Richland, or maybe dial it up a little bit, put the white ball up in the air.
I like it. I like it. By the way, I know that we didn't bring you on to talk about recruiting, but because you follow the SEC, the story that we have just been cracking up at is, how about Will Muschamp's kid going to Georgia? What does that say about the South Carolina program?
It says pretty much what we all know, is that there's nothing guaranteed for Will Muschamp or any coach in the SEC, by the way, beyond 2020. So what do we always tell recruits, right? Like, hey, go where you think you would be happiest as a student. Don't go where you think the coach is going to make you the happiest, right? So yeah. It looks like Will Muschamp is probably applying some of that same logic to kind of encouraging his son for where he should probably be playing his college football.
No doubt about it. I'll tell you what, in the SEC West, it's never lacking drama. Usually we're always trying to figure out whose year is it. Is it Alabama's year? Is this the year that Auburn sneaks into it? Is this the year that LSU rises up? All those have happened here recently, but now there's going to be a lot of attention in the state of Mississippi, and I'm not sure it's for all the right reasons, but man, the two head coaches there in that state, it should be fun at least.
Well, it's not for the wrong reasons, I can tell you that much. I'm pretty fired up about it. I mean, Mike Leach is a guy that recruited me, so I have a good relationship with him, and I was committed to Texas Tech for quite some time. So very familiar with the way he runs the program, and he is a bit of a unique character. There's no denying that. I do think that Mississippi State needed a shot in the arm, and Ole Miss, too, to a certain extent. And I feel like now, not only are they going to – well, at least you hope they're going to be more competitive on the football field. Maybe not quite as competitive as they were when Dan Mullen was pulling the trigger there and when Hugh Freeze was there, but I do think they'll be competitive on the football field. I believe that. But at least now we know that Mississippi's going to be, you know, front-page news. And regardless of whether they win or lose, people are going to be talking about what Lane Kiffin and Mike Leach did. And I think that's something that state and both their programs really needed, to kind of cement themselves in a bit of a unique way. And I think Oxford's a heck of a place, and I've actually really enjoyed my time in Starkville. So I'm cautiously optimistic about the direction that both programs are heading. It's just a matter of whether or not they can get the players in there and win games quickly enough to make sure they avoid another two-year hire where their guys let go.
Yeah,
and that's what happened with, obviously, Matt Luke and with Joe Moorhead. So, yeah. Like I said, cautiously optimistic, but kind of anxious to see the product on the field before I commit to any evaluation at this point.
If we're having this conversation in 3 years about Lane Kiffin and Mike Leach, who do you think we're talking about more 3 years from now? In other words, I'm basically asking you to project who, because somebody's going to be a winner and somebody's going to be a loser. So who do you think has the best shot of us talking more about their program 3 years from now?
Mike Leach. Honestly, like, I have the same doubts as everybody else has too. I don't know for certain that offense is going to work in the SEC. I think it'll work because it's worked everywhere else, but I can't tell you without a tight end and going against the defensive line personnel that he's going to go against on a weekly basis in the SEC. I don't know for certain that those guys are going to hold up, but I have seen him win at places that are really difficult to win. So Lane Kiffin, on the other hand, I think he's a good coach, but I think at this point he's still more of a lightning rod than he is a proven commodity. So I know that Lane Kiffin's going to do everything he can to try to capture attention, but I don't know if it's necessarily at a high-profile program. I don't know if it's necessarily going to turn into unbelievable results on the field. I hope it does. I think like all of us, but I don't know that for certain. Whereas I know Mike Leach will be able to get you 7-8 wins a year. And in that league, that's pretty dang solid.
Talking to Greg McElroy, ESPN, SEC Network. Does great work with college football, but we'll also be covering the XFL this year, and we'll get to that in just a second. But I got to bring up LSU and just the tremendous season that they had winning the national championship. And I know I was one of those people, Greg, that I looked at Ed Orgeron, like him. He's a great quote, great interview, but just didn't think he was going to get the job done, and he proved us all wrong. Now, he had a pretty darn good quarterback to help him along the way, but what was it about the buy-in with Ed O that worked for that team?
I wish I could explain it. I mean, I don't think I was critical of the hire.
Yeah.
And I've been around Ed O. He recruited me at Ole Miss. Like I've known Ed O for 15 years. So, and my thing is, we're talking about one of the top jobs in college football to me. I've always felt like LSU is one of the best, just with no in-state competition, a lot of incredible players, access to the Southeast and to the state of Texas. Like, I've always thought that that's a top five job in America. I've always felt that way. So when he got the job, I was like, look at his track record. I mean, golly, I mean, I feel like, I know he's from Louisiana, that makes sense, but what has he done to earn this job outside of doing a pretty good job in an interim situation? And honestly, I was dead wrong. Not only has he kind of invigorated the program, but he's kind of captivated an audience throughout the Southeast, and in the state of Louisiana, he can walk on water. So I think then that's huge, too, is having a fan base that closely associates with the coach. And I think that's been probably never better than what we see at both Clemson and at LSU. I think Dabo resonates with the fan base at Clemson, and clearly Ed O resonates with the fan base at LSU, and he's easy to support. So couldn't be happier for him and the fact that he has his dream job and is making the most of this opportunity, because it's rare that you get a second chance at this level, especially when things go as poorly as they did at Ole Miss. And for him to not only turn LSU around, but win a national championship in such short order and recruit the way he's recruiting, hire the coaches around him that he's hired, I mean, it's nothing short of remarkable.
So, Greg, you'll be on the call tomorrow. The XFL makes its debut on ABC, Seattle taking on D.C. alongside Steve Levy, Tom Luganbill, and Diana Russini. You can see that 1 o'clock Central Time here in Nashville. I'm curious of your perspective on this league, because as someone that you won a national championship, you had a very good college career, but then you go and you have the cup of coffee in the NFL. What would a league like this have meant for your playing career?
I would have played. And I think I would have absolutely played in the XFL or tried to play in the XFL because I was a fringe player. I was a guy on the roster in the NFL that was somewhere between 40 and 53. And, there's no shame in that. You're still one of the best players in the world if you're on the roster and you're between somewhere between 40 and 53. But all those guys that are between 40 and 53 on a 53-man roster are interchangeable. And what this does, and what the XFL does, is it provides you actual reps. I would go to practice, y'all, literally, in the NFL, in training camp. I would go to practice because they've shortened practices. There's no more two-a-days. They've made it easier on the veteran players with the new CBA that they rolled out in 2011 after the lockout. They wanted to basically prolong veteran players' careers, and that was a big talking point. But what they've done is they've eliminated opportunity for young players to develop and to get actual repetitions. Now, they're not referring to the XFL as a developmental league, and I don't think we need to refer to it as that because it's going to be a standalone. I think it's going to be very, very successful, full disclosure, because there are a lot of really, really good players that are on the bottom of an NFL roster that would much rather take the bird in the hand and play in a spring league in 10 games than grind it out on a practice squad where you're making less money and not getting any actual repetition towards developing your craft. So I, for one, would have played. And I wish this league existed 5 years ago because I would have teed it up. And I think I would have been a much better NFL player had I been given the opportunity to actually start and play more than two or three games a year in the preseason. So I'm a little remorseful about the timing, but I couldn't be happier to be associated with it, you know, as a broadcaster.
Well, and I think what's so interesting about it, you look at the first XFL and some other leagues that have come along the way, that they had this mindset of, oh, we're going to beat the NFL. We're going to give you an alternative to the NFL. And I don't think they've taken this approach. Vince McMahon has put football people in place. You have some pretty big name coaches that are a part of this. And while you said it's not a development league, it's a standalone, I do think that everybody understands that it can create opportunity for some of these guys to move on to the NFL, to make a 53-man roster, and then open the door for somebody else to come in and play in the XFL.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, and I think the league model's smart, and they're prioritizing quarterbacks, and quarterbacks are making a bunch of money, and really, really good money, comparable to that of an NFL rookie salary. So you're going to be able to attract guys on merit alone, but also, when you really take things into consideration, and there might be guys that... And there are guys in the XFL right now that had NFL opportunities that turned down NFL opportunities for a known commodity and being associated with the XFL. Landry Jones is one of those guys. So it's a shorter season. It's more predictable as far as whether or not you're going to make a roster. And I think it's attractive to guys that still have opportunities to play in the NFL. Of course, your dream is always to play in the NFL and secure a big deal and make a bunch of money. But there's clearly a place for the XFL and clearly a place to be, you know, highly successful if given the opportunity to play in the XFL.
What do you think about some of the rules that they're implementing in, as a quarterback, the double forward pass? I think that's going to be interesting.
I think the rules are smart. It's not going to be gimmicky, but I like the idea of encouraging people to go for it on fourth down, which means they're really, really penalizing touchbacks. Which means if you're in plus territory, you're probably going to go for it because you don't want to kick the ball into the end zone and let the other team get it at the 35-yard line. I think that's really smart. I think the way they've reinvented the kickoff is really smart to encourage kickoffs and to minimize the type of high-speed collisions. So that's really good. The double forward passes, I think we're spending a lot of time on it. I mean, how often are we going to see double forward passes? Once a game, maybe. But I think the kickoff and the extra point, the tiered extra point, makes for new strategy, and I think there's a lot of encouraging aspects to that.
So as we wrap this up, Greg, so obviously you're saying good things, which we want to hear. You think that, and I said this before we brought you on, their biggest obstacle and their hurdles out of the gates, or at least in the first season, is just gaining the trust, earning the trust from the fans out there, media, whatever, that it's going to last because we've gone through these leagues and they come and they go quicker than, you know, a blink of
right.
an eye. And so you think 3 years from now we're still talking about this league?
Yes. Okay. I think it exists. I think there's a place for it. So clearly the focus groups that they've used tell you that there's an appetite for football. And I think to a certain extent, too, this thing's well-resourced. And guess what? You know where to find us.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to be on every Saturday at 2 o'clock Eastern on ABC. Every Saturday. And I think some of the previous leagues – they didn't have their ducks in a row as far as when we can watch the game. Like, for instance, I watched the AAF last year. But I never knew where to find it. Am I on the NFL Network? Am I on TNT?
Mm-hmm.
Am I on CBS Sports? Am I on CBS? Never knew where to find it. So I think having broadcast windows where you know what to expect is going to make it a little bit easier for people to comprehend. And I think you'll recognize way, way, way more players than you probably anticipate. So I think there's an appetite for it, and I think there's a place for it. And I expect the quality of play to be really good, and that's really what it's all about,
yeah.
is how good is the quality of play. If the play is terrible, it's not going to be good. But knowing the players on the roster, I feel pretty good about what we can expect from the teams that we're going to see here in the weeks to come.
Well said. Hope you're right. And we'll certainly be checking it out starting this weekend for sure. We always enjoy the visit. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Phil. Sorry I'm out of breath. I'm walking around D.C.
You're good.
It's all good. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg.
See y'all.
Greg McElroy, ESPN, SEC Network, and now the XFL. And he's going to be in the booth with whom, did you say?
Steve Levy,
wow.
And Tom Luginbill, and also Diana Russini.
Wow. There you go. You just heard it. Saturdays at 2.
Yeah.
You know there'll be a game.
Yeah, and then on Sunday, ESPN has the 5 o'clock game, or the 4 o'clock game Tom Hart, Joey Galloway, Pat McAfee, that team. So
we'll come back with more of Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're going to encourage you to go to thegamenashville.com and enter to win your loved one, the Luxon House Day Spa in Franklin, a Valentine's Couples Retreat Package. Listen for this. It's valued at $650. That should have your attention. You and your special someone could receive a Swedish massage plus a facial and pedicure. Couples Retreat includes 2 50-minute Swedish massages, 2 classic European facials, and some pedicures. There you go. Go to thegamenashville.com to enter to win. Valentine's Day, a week from today. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to head up to Edmonton. Preds and Oilers tomorrow night's hockey night in Canada. 6 o'clock puck drop. I'll have pregame for you starting at 5. Preds are now 7-1-1 in their last 9 road games. I can't explain it.
That is just such a weird stat.
They have now won 15 road games this year. They are 500 at home. Actually, they're really below 500. Right? I mean, I know you get a point.
Yeah.
But those were losses in overtime or shootouts. So they're below 500. And I can't explain. And I saw this stat last night. I passed it along late in the night in postgame. Their goal differential, home and road. I don't know if this is a stat you're proud of or not. I don't know. I don't know how you're supposed to feel about it. They lead the NHL. They have the highest goal differential on how they play on the road as opposed to how they play at home. In other words, they're having way more success scoring goals on the road than they are at home. They're number one in the league.
I just don't know. That's one of those things that I asked Brent Peterson about, and I've asked other people, and we've talked about it on the show. I just can't explain it, what it is, because Bridgestone Arena used to be their yard. They'd come in here, and you knew 9 times out of 10 the Predators were going to win on home ice. And for whatever reason, it just hasn't translated to that this year. And really, going back to some last year, that they had some struggles at home and the playoffs and stuff like that. So I can't explain it. I don't know if they're just in their own head, if they have less distraction when they're out on the road and they just take care of business. I don't know what it is, but it's crazy. It's crazy to try to explain it.
They have the largest reverse split in the NHL. So they are number one in that department. The Canadiens are second. The Winnipeg Jets are third. By the way, Winnipeg has not played well at home.
Yeah, which that's – we've been there. We know what kind of atmosphere that is.
Isn't that crazy? And the Maple Leafs and the Capitals. Those are the top 5 teams in the NHL that have their largest goal per game differential higher on the road than at home. Predators are number 1, followed by the Canadiens, the Jets, the Leafs, and the Capitals.
Wow. That, I mean,
like I said, I don't know what that means. I mean, I don't know what that translates to.
I don't know how you fix it.
They're having more success on the road. We know that. I just told you they have 15 wins on the road this season. They're 7-1-1 in their last 9 road games. Home, they're below 500 mm-hmm. in actuality. I mean, like I said, they get a point for some of those overtime and shootout losses, which, oh, by the way, one of them was to Calgary on Halloween night.
Yeah.
When they were up 4-1 after 2 periods. And gave up 4 goals in the third. Went to overtime, tied at 5. Remember Matthew Tkachuk had the goal with 1 second remaining?
Yeah. Oh, and that was such a heartbreaker, too. And that's, you know, you brought it up. We talked about it, that it's kind of when things really started to snowball for the Predators. But,
was not a good carryover into the month of November.
No. No, not at all. But, it's just so weird to explain of why they've had these struggles on home ice. But I'm hoping, this is what I hope, because you look at the past 2 games, they've scored on the power play, they've killed penalties, they've won. You've had guys that have struggled throughout the year that are now starting to get into a rhythm and they're playing much better. I'm hoping that as a team that just builds up their confidence, and then they can carry that over when they come home, because they do have a homestand, a pretty legit homestand coming up. And I'm hoping that if they come back off the road and they're feeling good about themselves and they have that confidence, that, you know, it won't be a thing anymore. It'll just be like, all right, we're going to just go out and take care of business. And, you know, yeah, you got the home stuff that you have to deal with, and, you know, that just the house and the family and all that. But it should, with confidence, I think, take care of a lot of that. But they just got to keep this up. You know, as I said to start the show, 3 in a row. That's a winning streak, according to the movie Major League. So if they can get the win tomorrow, then they're feeling good. You finish out the road trip strong in Vancouver, and then you carry that over to home ice. It's just one game at a time, keeping it going. But they've been playing well. They've played solid the last two games.
I thought you were about to pull a cardboard cutout of John Hines and put it in studio. I didn't know what you were about to do.
I wouldn't use John Hines for that.
No?
No.
Who would you use?
Maybe Sean Henry. We could put Sean Henry there on the cardboard cutout.
Okay.
I hope you're listening, Sean.
Whatever works.
Exactly.
If that works.
There's only one thing left to do. Win the whole beeping thing.
I guess when I said I don't know what that means, I probably do know what that means, at least right now to this point in the season. It means when you have a higher goal differential on the road than at home, you're not a playoff team.
Yeah.
Because four of those five teams are not in the playoffs. The Capitals are the only one that are bucking that trend where they're not good. They were fifth on this list, so their goal differential is a lot different than the Predators, the Canadiens, the Jets, and the Leafs, really. They're like a huge drop-off. It's like those four and then the kind of a drop-off to five. But the Capitals are not only in the playoffs, they're winning their division. And when the Predators just played them and beat them, they were they're the number one team in the league. So they're the one that's overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
The other four have not. So I guess when I say I don't know what it means, that means that it's not a good thing, because – the top four of those teams are currently on the outside looking into the playoff picture.
Yeah. And look, you know, from the Predators' point of view, you look at this, the rest of this month, not only this road trip, but the rest of the month, this schedule's not easy at all. I mean, it gets more compact, it gets harder, and they have games at home, and, you know, you kind of think, all right, that's a good thing. But based on the conversation we're having, you're hoping they can turn it around, because the home game that they have after Vancouver – next Thursday, the New York Islanders are pretty good, and everybody should be familiar with their head coach. Not an easy game, and then you go on the road to St. Louis for one, and then back to Bridgestone Arena for a Sunday game against St. Louis. So you do back-to-backs with St. Louis. Not easy. Not an easy stretch. So it's all about building that confidence in my mind, because we've said it time and time again, the team is talented enough, it's just putting it all together.
All right, we'll come back, head up to Edmonton. That's next up for the Preds, game three of this four-game road trip. We'll learn a little bit more about their opponent tomorrow night. We do that next on Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Back here on Darren Donick and Chase on this Friday. Preds next up. This Western Canada swing. Game three of this four-game road trip in Edmonton. Tomorrow night, 6 o'clock. Little hockey night in Canada up there. I'll have pregame for you starting at 5 right here on 102.5 The Game. Then they'll close things out in Vancouver on Monday night before coming back home for just a one-game homestand. That'll be Thursday night against Barry Trotz and Company, New York Islanders. But right now, we talk to Jim Matheson, who's been covering the Oilers. I don't believe this is his first year covering the Oilers.
He's
not
a rookie.
So. No, I don't even think it's his second year. He's with the Edmonton Journal. He's on the line with us. Jim, how you doing?
Very good. Yeah, it's a little more than 1 or 2 years. It's since 1979, so that's 40 years.
Wow.
You remember some guy named Gretzky, I guess.
Probably older than both you guys, right?
You may have us. You may have us on that. What they're coming? By the way, the Oilers last night, a stinging loss at home to the Sharks when the Predators were taking care of business in Calgary. Edmonton lost to a San Jose team that's certainly had their struggles this year. What happened last night?
Well, they've had trouble manufacturing emotion since the two wild games against the Calgary Flames.
Yeah.
And then they beat St. Louis in between those two games. They've had trouble manufacturing the same amount of emotion the last two games, losing to Arizona 3-0 and then 6-3 to San Jose. But these are the Oilers. This year, they've beaten a lot of teams that are in the playoffs handily. Beaten Washington, they've beaten Pittsburgh, they've beaten St. Louis, beaten Colorado. They beat lots of good teams, but they've lost two games to Buffalo and they lost a game to Detroit this year. And those are certainly two of the worst teams in the league. So they're kind of one of those, you never know what you're going to get from the Oilers. So the whole Pacific Division is close. I don't know how good it is, but it's certainly good, close enough from fifth to first, which will make it very interesting in the trading deadline because I'm sure all five teams will be trying to trade for something.
Yeah, that's a good point. Jim, if you could, just paint the picture here for everybody listening in Nashville. You brought up their games that certainly got a lot of recognition. If you weren't paying attention, it was very clear Edmonton and Calgary do not like each other. The close proximity, that's a huge rivalry. It's a big deal up there. I know our own Chris Mason is from Red Deer, and I believe that's dead smack in the middle.
Dead smack in the middle, and I don't know when Chris was growing up if he was an Oiler fan or a Calgary Flames fan, but when you're living in Red Deer, you can be one or the other because it's about 180 miles between Edmonton and Calgary, and Red Deer is about 90 miles right in the middle. So, yeah, you can be one of the other.
Yeah, and so there's no love lost. They were fighting and throwing the gloves down, and it was wild and wacky to watch. But just kind of paint the picture. What is that rivalry like? Because clearly those two teams don't like each other.
It's not quite as vicious as it used to be back in the 80s when the Oilers were the best team in the league and Calgary might have been the second best team in the league. And they played in the same division and they played each other seemed like 20 times a year if you counted playoffs and regular season. So geographically, certainly they're, as you said, they're 190 miles apart. They're about the same size city, around 1 million people. The Oilers have won a lot more than Calgary has won. Calgary's won one Stanley Cup, Edmonton's won five. But, you know, the problem with geographic rivals, I guess it would be the same as Philadelphia and Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. It helps if both teams are relevant. Often one team's really good and the other team's not, and the only rivalry is that you're in the same state or same province and geographic. In this case, both Edmonton and Calgary are within a couple of points of one another, so the games mean a lot more. So emotions are a little higher pitched. And, last game, the Oilers not only beat them on the scoreboard, but there was lots of fights, too, including Mike Smith, the goalie, fighting Cam Talbot. And haven't seen one of those fights ever in the Battle of Alberta. So it's interesting. Unfortunately, the Oilers don't play Calgary again until April 4th, last game of the regular season. That's 2 months from now. So we got Oceans three games in about 10 days, and now they don't play again for 2 months. So unfortunate, but I know one thing. In the States, NBC probably, the sports channel, and in Canada, Sportsnet want to see Edmonton play Calgary in the playoffs because even if you're not fully in tune with Edmonton and Calgary because they don't play in the same division or you happen to be in the East, it's must-view games when you've got certainly McDavid and Draisaitl on the Oilers and you've got a lot of animosity between the two teams.
Jim Matheson on the line with us, covers the Oilers for Edmonton Journal. I think this is season three of Rogers Place, their new beautiful arena in downtown Edmonton. What has that new arena done for the organization and just that fan base? Is it right year three of Rogers Place?
Year four.
Year four,
year
okay.
Four. And to be honest, I don't like it as much as the old barn. The other one was a hockey barn. Whether it was called Rexall Place or Northlands Coliseum or whatever, it was a hockey rink. This is just a hockey rink and an entertainment facility, and it's awfully big. it's not as cozy as it could be. I mean, the Oilers are 13-9-4 at home, so they're not exactly blowing the doors off visiting teams. And the fan base is quite down this year. Even though the team is better than it was last year, there's been lots of games this year. I would say 90% of the games this year are not sold out, and they were sold out forever and ever. Well, if they, you might have the best player in the world in McDavid, and certainly one of the top 10 players in the NHL in Drysdale, but when you keep missing the playoffs and the ticket prices are high, the fan just said, "I'm not paying it. I'm not buying a season ticket anymore. I can go online if I want to see one game for the most part and buy a ticket." And the price of tickets here, you can go out and buy a 62-inch TV and plunk it in your living room and watch the game on TV for what it costs to go to one Oiler game. So if you take, you know, a couple of kids and your wife, so you may as well. They got to win back those fans somehow, and by winning them back, they have to make the playoffs. And they've only made the playoffs once since they were in the Stanley Cup final in 2006. So Buffalo and the Oilers seem to be mirror images of one another. Not very good regular season teams.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so you brought up, everybody knows Connor McDavid and Draisaitl. I mean, those two guys are just offensive machines. But as a whole, as this team is constructed, as we sit here in February, and you've talked about them missing the playoffs more than getting in, right now they're in. What do you think of the way this team is constructed, and what do you think is going to be the objective or the game plan, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, going into the trade deadline, which is just around the corner?
Well, the team is flawed. They have, as you said, the first, you know, Draisaitl leads the league in scoring, and McDavid, who's second, and one guy's got 83 points and the other guy's got 80. So they have superstars, but they don't have enough good players, forwards, for them to play with. So unlike a lot of teams with lots of good sport players and no superstars, the others are the other way. They need somebody for McDavid to play with who plays left wing, preferably somebody who skates fast like he does. And they've been looking for one all year. They've tried former, you know, Predator James Neal on left wing, and they had Draisaitl there to start the season, and had a checker, Josh Archibald's been there for a while. So he really doesn't have a left winger. They need that, and they need a third-line center. And we've mentioned Nick Bonino's name, but that was when Nashville wasn't winning too many games, and we thought that maybe, you know, there might be something there if the Oilers could construct a deal where Nashville paid some of his $4 million contract next year. But one thing about Ken Holland, he's been in the league for over 20 years as a general manager, and he knows if you usually improve your team, try to anyway at the trading deadline if you're in the picture. And he's in the picture, but I just don't know if he thinks his team is that good or that deep to go very far in the playoffs. So he's not willing to give up a whole lot. He just needs to, I think, nibble around the edges and improve the team to a degree, as David Poyle's probably thinking the same thing. You know, all general managers think the same way. If your team's sort of in the playoff picture, you owe it to the players to try and get something for them. But you don't want to swing for a home run if you don't think your team's going to go that deep in the playoffs. And I suspect that Nashville and Edmonton are probably in the same boat. They've done okay in the regular season, but how far are they going to go in the playoffs? They don't want to give up a whole lot in terms of rentals and stuff like that just to win a round. So we'll see.
Jim, based off of all of that, and you mentioned Ken Holland and then Dave Tippett, the head coach, do you feel like, though, that if given some time, that combination is going to be exactly what the Oilers need to develop the young talent that they have?
I think so. Their depth in the organization is on defense. They have lots of good young defensemen, and if they're looking to trade, they would be trading some of those young defensemen. They don't have very many forwards coming. But as long as you've got Holland, who won, you know, lots of three Stanley Cups in Detroit, and Dave Tippett has won a lot of games as a coach, I think they're in very good hands. I think the fan base here isn't so keen on winning a Stanley Cup. They just want to get into the playoffs, as they did 2 years ago in 2017, where they got to the game seven of the second round. And then since then, they've missed the playoffs. So I think they just want to get in the playoffs and see what happens. And Holland's the same way. He knows he doesn't have a team that's going to win a Stanley Cup now, but if he can get some players to play around McDavid and Dreisaitl, so be it. That'd be great, you know. And that's why they traded for James Neal as a support player, you know, a top six player. And Neal's had one of those a very strange season. He's got 19 goals. He's only one shy of getting 20 for the 11th time, but he scored 9 of those 19 goals in 3 games. So he had a 4-goal game against the Islanders in October, and he had a hat trick against the Rangers on New Year's Eve, and a 2-goal game against LA in October. And like I said, half of his goals in 3 games, and he's got 19, but he hasn't scored a goal since he got the hat trick against the Rangers on New Year's Eve. So very strange season for him.
And I know he's been hurt. Is he any closer to getting back?
Oh, he might be. He's missed the last 4 games. He's got a sore ankle, but he did skate yesterday morning, morning skate for the San Jose game. So, I mean, I'm sure there's a possibility. They haven't had practice yet, so we'll see if he's on a line today or he's just, an extra forward. But he's been really good on the power play with 12 power play goals, but only 7 even strength. So they need more even strength goals from James Neal. But like I said, 19 goals is still 19 goals. And last time I looked, it's only McDavid and Dreisaitl with more goals than Neal's 19. So he's been just fine.
Should be an interesting tilt tomorrow night. Jim, I really appreciate the visit. Enjoy the game.
Okay, will do. And I'm sure it'll be Nashville's playing good. And I'm curious to see if they go with Saros in goal again after he's won the last 2, or they come back with a veteran.
And Pekka's had a lot of success against Edmonton, so it's something we've talked about.
He got beat last time, though. He got beat last time by Mike Smith, and that was one of the few times he's lost.
Yep.
So I guess we'll see. I know there's a better chance that they're stopping pucks than Mike Smith's fighting Pekka Rinne, so we'll see.
You're probably right about that. Thank you, Jim.
Okay, take care.
All right, Jim Matheson, Edmonton Journal, covers the Oilers. 6 o'clock puck drop tomorrow night up in Edmonton, and I'll have pregame for you at 5. Everything heard right here on 102.5 The Game. We'll come back and close up shop for the second hour of Darren Donick and Chase next. You just made the list coming up at noon.
I am ready for that.
Pick 6 at 1.
I got
good prizes attached to it. I do too. I'm ready. I was telling Chase during the break, we're watching Oliver Luck on is this Outside the Lines?
Yeah. Yeah.
Outside the Lines, and I said I used to work with Oliver Luck's brother.
Such a small world.
So we were like, This crew, we worked in the summers at a country club in Cleveland, Ohio called Mayfield Country Club. And it was like Caddyshack. The grounds crew was made up of all college kids and high school kids. Mayfield Country Club's really nice. So Oliver Luck's brother was Tim Luck, who was going to Cincinnati. He was on the grounds crew. Cool dude. At the time, I'm trying to think, was Oliver in the league as a quarterback?
What year would this have been?
So this would have been, well, we've got to go back in the way back machine.
Because he played
early 90s.
Yeah. Well, no, 80s. Yeah, he played 82 to 86 with the Oilers.
No. So that's when his career ended in the NFL? Then, yeah, his brother was out. I'm trying to remember, what was his brother doing? I know Oliver played at West Virginia in college. I don't remember what Oliver was. Oh, was he running NFL Europe?
He was the GM of Frankfurt from 91 to 92. And then
that's what he was.
From Rain. The fire from 95 to 96.
So when I was working with his brother, Tim, he was running NFL Europe, or he was a GM for NFL Europe.
And then he was the president of NFL Europe from 96 to 2000.
And Tim was cool dude.
Mm-hmm.
Used to hang with him all the time. And also on that staff was Tom Sheets. And his dad was a prominent doctor in Cleveland. Tom was going into his senior year at Ohio State. Tom was a very normal looking guy. Like you, I'll tell you why I'm saying that. Very normal looking. If you saw him, he'd be like just like a college kid. I mean, no, there would be nothing that would jump out at you. And he'd always bring in cassettes at the time, because remember, I'm dating when this was, and he would bring cassettes and have us all listen to his band. He was in a band. And I remember the first time I heard it, I was like, gosh, you guys are pretty good. Like, that's just not some guys in a garage hanging out. Like, you guys are good. And he said they were on the cusp of making it. And I remember he came in one day, and he was really down. Tom was, you know, upbeat guy. We had a lot of fun. That crew, we had a very interesting, I could go on and on. I mean, it was to know all of us worked together at this country club. But like I said, it was a little bit like Caddyshack. We had fun. Sometimes too much fun.
Imagine that.
But when you're, you know, a bunch of college kids and high school kids, you're usually going to have a lot of fun. Tom was a pretty upbeat guy. He came in pretty down. I was like, Tom, what's up? He said the lead singer of our band called last night. He said he's given me 24 hours to make up my mind on whether I'm going to Europe with them or not, because they're going to Europe to try to make it. And I'm like, really? And he was going into his senior year at Ohio State. So it's not like he just started. He's in his senior year. I mean, he's going into his final year to graduate. Like I said, he came from money. His dad was a prominent doctor at Ohio State. And I remember we had gone downtown, like the whole, like a big group of us from that country club. I was telling Chase this, that it was a bar called Nine of Clubs. It was in downtown Cleveland. It was kind of a gothic place, which kind of surprised me. Like I said, Tom was very normal looking. None of us had ever been to Nine of Clubs. And we walk in, we're like, oh, wow. It's kind of like, you know, techno. And it's just, it was dark. It's like, oh, okay. This is not really kind of our cup of tea, but whatever. Tom's cool dude. His band was there. He wanted us to meet his band. And I told Chase I had, you know, no idea. All I have is look at Tom and think that they were just going to be some normal-looking dudes. And he introduces me to the lead singer, and I'm like, holy crap. Whoa, hello. They were kind of scary. Like, I was like, wow, like, that's the band Tom is in? Like, I remember we were all like talking away from him going, can you believe that's the band he's in? Like, those guys are scary, especially the lead singer. Really? Well, Tom decided not to go with the band. So he was the keyboardist for this band, and he chose to stay behind. That band.
How'd that work out for him?
That band went across the way and made it. They came back huge. That band was Nine Inch Nails.
Hmm.
And that lead singer I met that night was Trent Reznor.
Mm.
And I was like, man, that dude is scary.
They have been quite successful, though.
I've always wondered, did Tom Sheets, does he regret it? I don't even know. I have no clues. He may be a prominent doctor for all I know. I haven't talked to him in 25 years plus. But I always wonder, I have to believe he lives with regret, right? I guess.
Two totally different life paths. I mean, they almost couldn't be more opposite.
I know.
His life would be completely different.
And like I said, if I introduced you guys back then.
And that's Trent Reznor now.
Yeah, that's. Trent, let me just tell you right now, when I met Trent Reznor, he didn't look like that. Like, yeah, that picture you're showing cut. Me is pretty normal looking. He didn't look like that back then. That's more like what Tom looked like. Like, that would make sense.
That was back in the day.
Yeah.
I know this is radio, but
He went, he was in, his band was Nine Inch Nails.
That is crazy.
He's like, yeah, guys, thanks. I think I'm going to stay behind, man.
There's so many stories like that, though, you know, especially around here.
But that was just two guys that I work with. I could go on. Two guys. One was the keyboardist for Nine Inch Nails.
And the other was,
Oliver Luck's brother.
Small world. And then there's you. What'd you do?
Not much. Not much compared to those guys.
Well,
there was some other.
You're a big deal in my heart. There you go.
Oh, thanks, Chase.
You're welcome.
It makes me feel good. I'm going to cry.
Good.
By the way, you did have the wine yesterday. That was pretty good.
Which one?
About.
Oh, the big cheese?
The big cheese.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The big cheese line.
Yeah. You're like, well, you're welcome.
Scott, he never calls me the big cheese.
It's true.
But, you know, that I'm sure people out there listening, they all have a story like that, right? An encounter with somebody or somebody they knew through somebody else or somebody they worked with way back in the day, and who would have ever known that either they did make it, they yeah. chose, okay, let's do this, or they chose not to, or just a crazy story. I mean, I'm sure all of us have that.
I had a professor in college that my freshman year, it was a mass comm class that I was taking at MTSU. And he tells us on like the first day, he's telling more about him and he's showing us videos of his time in the industry. And he said, but my biggest, I guess he can't necessarily regret it because he didn't get the job, but he tells the story of how he was the finalist to be the host of a game show and that it came down to him and one other person. And he got beat out by the weatherman from Los Angeles, Pat Sajak.
Yeah.
He was the finalist for Wheel of Fortune. Oh, how his life would look.
How different it would be.
Yeah.
Well, you've met one of my friends. I went out to El Paso, Texas to catch up with a college roommate of mine who was working for the Sun Bowl. And there was a big basketball tournament out in El Paso around the Sun Bowl Classic. And it was like UTEP and Washington and Stanford and then somebody else, like a lesser school, in this tournament. And this guy was helping my buddy, who I was going out there to visit. They grew up together in Pittsburgh. That buddy was Hammer. Who
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he has gone on to be in, I don't know if he's not a soap star. He's more like a fill-in on soap operas. He's won games. Bingo America, he won 100,000. He's been on game shows. He lives out in L.A.
Hammer time.
And we were friends ever since that meet. We literally met on that trip. He was out there visiting the same guy I was. And the next thing you know, we've been friends ever since. He's done some pretty cool things in L.A. Yeah. Everybody's got those stories.
Then there's you.
And then once again, it just always comes back to then there's me. And it's like, and that's where the story ends. We'll come back. You just made the list. Maybe you'll put me on the list for telling those stories. We do that to kick off the third hour of Darren, Donick, and Chase next.